Something unusual about this map. How often have you seen Russia in blue? You know, normally we think of red. But this is a map from 1914. This is at the beginning of World War I. It is before the Russian Revolution in 1917. The reason that I have this up here is that my family is from Finland, and you will notice there in the yellow circles the area of Finland, but there was no country of Finland. Finland was owned by Russia. My maternal grandfather was of draft age and was about to be drafted by the Russian army. And the Russians had a policy that if you went into the army, they never allowed you to return home. In other words, when you got out of your service, you were thousands and thousands of miles away from where you originated, and they didn't want people going back after they had received their military training because maybe they could lead a revolution. So as my grandfather was approaching draft age, he had some older brothers that had found their way to Middle River, Minnesota, and to Hibbing, Minnesota. And so actually Mountain Iron, Minnesota, so he wanted to go to the United States. So he saved up money, and he booked a ship and went from Finland to New York. Okay, well, you know, you arrive in New York, and we know all about the Statue of Liberty, but there's one stop that all immigrants would make, and that was Ellis Island. And at Ellis Island, they told him, "We have already reached the quota of Finns for this year. You can't come in." So he went up to Canada. Now, his formal training in English up to this point had been that there were some classes on the ship as they were going across the ocean. He had a pocket knife and he had a fish hook. That was basically all he had. And he would work for people and gradually worked his way across Canada. Well, then he got into Western Ontario, and the area circled by red is the Rainy River. And down below you see a red triangle, and that's where Mountain Iron is. One moonless night, someone rode him across the Rainy River, and he walked another 100 miles to Mountain Iron. So one of my ancestors was an illegal immigrant. He did receive his American citizenship after a number of years and so on and so forth, so eventually he did become legal. Interestingly enough, as we look at this passage that we're going to consider, Jacob and his family were members of an occupation and an ethnic group that Egypt wasn't particularly interested in having emigrate into Egypt. And we're going to see how the Lord superintended to make it so that they not only lived there, but they thrived there. But it was strictly because of the Lord's provision. Because of what Joseph had done for the nation of Egypt, Pharaoh was quite willing to overlook things that otherwise would have been serious issues. And provision was made for Joseph's family. Let's begin at Genesis chapter 46, starting at verse 31. We have the summary statements of how the members of the family had all arrived, but now we're going to see how provision is going to be made for them. In verses 31 through 34, Joseph explained to his family how he would approach Pharaoh and what they should say in response. In verses 31 to 32, Joseph said that he would tell Pharaoh that his family were shepherds who brought their flocks. Verse 31. Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds. Word is roeh. For their occupation has been to feed livestock, and they have brought their flocks, their herds, and all that they have. So Joseph is saying, okay, I'm cluing you in this time. He hadn't clued them in before, and you remember how many times they were wondering, what's this guy doing? Are we about ready to be caught? Has God found us out for our evil? But at this point, it's important for them to know what it is that Joseph is going to do, that provision is going to be made, and that there are certain things for them to say. So he is telling them, I am going to talk to Pharaoh, and I'm going to pave the way for you, and I'm going to tell him your occupation. We're not going to lie about your occupation. You are shepherds. In verses 33 to 34, we find out a little more. Joseph now has instructions for his family. He tells them to tell Pharaoh that they were herdsmen. Egyptians detest shepherds. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. They say, now this is odd. He wants them to be welcomed in, so tell them that you do something that they just really detest. And you look at that and you say, wow, is Joseph setting us up for a fall here? You know, what's going on here? Well, actually, there are several significant things here. Pharaoh's going to be interested, what is your occupation? Are you able to make an economic contribution? We've been hearing a lot about that in recent days and weeks in the news, haven't we? And they are to say that their occupation has been with livestock. That is, they're shepherds. They're animal tenders. And it's not just us. This is what our families have done. And you look back, and yes, that's what Isaac did. That's what Abraham did. Now, they are to say this, that they may dwell in the land of Goshen. If they had given a different answer, they would have been assigned somewhere else. That's actually going to be a very important thing. This is how they're going to end up in Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. What in particular was it that was so detestable about shepherds? Well, shepherds tended to be nomadic, didn't they? And you remember how, as we look through the narrative of Genesis, you find Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob in one place, and then you find them in another place, and then you find them in another place, and they're always moving around. In a nation that's concerned about securing its borders, having people who are wandering around within the country is not exactly what they want to be happening. It's a little too early for it to be major competition with their cotton, because cotton was extremely expensive since the cotton gin was not invented until Eli Whitney invented it here in the United States. So cotton was strictly a very well-to-do type of cloth, that is linen. that which would come from goats or sheep and so on and so forth wasn't really in serious competition. But the main issue seems to be they didn't like nomads. They looked at them and essentially thought of them as gypsies or homeless people, and they didn't want that to be the case. Under normal circumstances, what would happen if they were to say, hey, we're sheep herders. We're here at the point of entry. Well, like my grandfather, go to that country just north of us. But like my grandfather had Sisu, the Finnish national ethic, you know what the Finnish national virtue is. Sisu, stubbornness. Who else would start 18 wars with Russia? Finns are stubborn, so were these people. Well, now they've gotten their instructions from Joseph as to what they are to say and how he's going to prepare the way for them by saying that they were shepherds. So in verses 1 through 6 of 47, Joseph presented his brothers to Pharaoh, who then asked about their occupation. The following passage, verses 7 through 10, he's going to present his father to Pharaoh. But now he's presenting his brothers, and he's going to ask their occupation. In verses 1 through 2, Joseph told Pharaoh that his family brought their herds from Canaan and are in Goshen, then presented his brothers to him. Verse 1. Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen. And he took 5 men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. So notice, the point where Joseph goes to talk to Pharaoh, he says, by the way, all the animals are already here. They've come. Remember, you extended that invitation, and we sent carts, and we brought all of their possessions, brought all the family, brought all the little ones, and we brought all the livestock. And all that livestock is here. It's in Goshen. And Pharaoh's saying, well, Goshen's quite a way away from here. Goshen would be a good place for them. Now, actually, we're going to find out momentarily that it was a very good place for them in more than one way. So what he did was he took 5 of his brothers, probably the ones that he thought would make the best impression on Pharaoh, and he presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh can't really back off and say, well, wow. Joseph, I didn't really know that they were shepherds. Joseph has presented this, said it doesn't come as a surprise, and Pharaoh has to say, okay, I really like Joseph. He's taken care of us. Goshen would be a good place for them. Well, let's see, where is Goshen? Goshen is adjacent to the Nile Delta, but it is an area that has more solid ground than that which you have in the Nile itself, or in the Delta itself. That becomes an issue, and I come from a place that we had similar soil conditions very close to where I grew up. And since we worked in moving dirt, you get familiar with how dirt handles different types of dirt. So let's go north here in California for some background information. This is the San Joaquin-Sacramento Delta. San Joaquin River is in the southern part of the Central Valley, and then the Sacramento River drains the northern portion of the valley. When you get to Stockton, which is 90 miles inland from the Bay Area, it's only 20 feet above sea level. You go 90 miles inland and you're only up 20 feet. The water really slows down as it gets into this area, and you notice how it sort of is a triangular shape, just as the Nile Delta is a triangular shape. In this area, there are 1,800 miles of navigable waterway. In other words, if you were to get in a boat and you wanted to go down different streams and rivers and sloughs and so on and so forth, you could actually cover 1,800 linear miles just in the area that's here in this map. Now, down here is where it becomes salt water. All of this is fresh water up in here. Now, like when I took Frank up there one time, he said, as we went out in the Delta and he was looking at the soil, he said, you know, they bag this stuff up, peat moss, and sell it for a lot of money in nurseries, right? And here it was everywhere for an area about the size of Rhode Island. There aren't very many houses out there because one of the problems with peat dirt is it burns. And they sometimes get peat fires. It's also very soft. You don't have much of a foundation. Now, the picture that I'm going to show you here first is with regard to horses and not on peat dirt, but on snow. Look at those horseshoes. Those are not ordinary horseshoes because attached to the horseshoes are snowshoes. When they farmed with horses in the Delta, they had to have similar snowshoes for the horses so that they wouldn't sink down in the peat dirt. And the San Joaquin Delta is also the place where the Caterpillar tractor was invented in 1904. Because before they came up with the idea of tracks to distribute the weight, the only way that they could make a traction engine survive or to stay on top was to make the wheels wide. I have pictures, but unfortunately they're in Denver, so I couldn't scan them, of one traction engine that each wheel was 30 feet wide. So when Benjamin Holt made this, he calculated that it was the equivalent of a 77-foot diameter wheel. And that made it so that the tractor would float on top of the peat dirt. This replica was built by a friend of mine who lives over in Ontario. It's a one-of-a-kind. It's the only replica Holt steamer in existence in the whole world. None of the originals have survived. You can't raise livestock in the Delta. Because can you imagine having animals sinking down into the peat dirt? If you ever were to drive through the Delta, you can tell immediately where the soil becomes firm because you start seeing a few houses and you start seeing livestock. But in the Delta itself, it's very rich farmland, but it's not suitable for livestock. Goshen is a place that has good water, access to water, but it's on firm soil. It's going to be a logical place to have livestock. And if they receive the choicest of the land, well, they're not going to be migrating all over the rest of the country, are they? Because not much of the rest of the country was as suitable as Goshen for what they wanted. And Goshen was far enough away from the main Egyptian population centers that the Egyptians said, we don't have to deal with those people. They're there in Goshen. Why is this all so important? Well, if you remember, the Israelites, Jacob's family, had gotten too friendly with Canaanites, didn't they? And what did God do? God put them in a country that wanted to keep them isolated. And how does Pharaoh keep them isolated? He gives them the best land they could possibly have for raising their animals. Isn't it an interesting thing, the way that the Lord works? So, now in verses 3 and 4, Pharaoh asked them about their occupation. And they said they were shepherds and wished to sojourn in Goshen because the famine destroyed their pastures. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to dwell in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." They've asked permission. They've already got the animals here, and they say, "Could we stay here? This looks like a wonderful place, and Joseph has already told us that you were planning to give land that would be suitable for us, and this looks like a nice place. Doesn't seem like it's all that attractive to you folks. Would it be all right?" And so, sure enough, in verses 5 and 6, Pharaoh offered Joseph choice land for them, for the brothers, and requested for Joseph to put capable men over his herds. Verse 5, "Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, 'Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and your brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock.'" Pharaoh says, "Well, okay, we're going to follow through on this, but you know, you have done a pretty good job here for us. If you have any brothers you could make recommendations of, we'd be happy to have them help out with our livestock as well." That is the livestock that Pharaoh owned. Well, now in verses 7 through 10, Joseph is going to introduce his father Jacob to Pharaoh. So Joseph presented Jacob to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Verse 7. "Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, 'How old are you?'" So notice here what we have is the introduction, just as we had an introduction with the brothers, and Joseph has brought in his father separately. It's a separate set of discussions because it's more like a business discussion with the brothers. But the father is here as a matter of honor. Well, then, in verse 9, in verse 8, Pharaoh asked Jacob his age, who said his pilgrimage was 130 few and evil years, actually less than his ancestors. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. And they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." The way that Jacob characterizes himself, he twice speaks of pilgrimage, his own pilgrimage and that of his forefathers. It's a very logical way for someone who is a nomadic sheep herder to view his life. He sees himself as just passing through. But let's think about it. What had God promised Abraham? What had God promised to Isaac? And what had God promised to Jacob? That he would make them into a great nation, and he would give them a land, not Egypt, but a land that bordered on Egypt. God is close as the river of Egypt. River of Egypt is not the Nile River. And what land did the patriarchs actually own there? They bought two burial plots. That's the extent of their land ownership. They were wanderers. And how was it that the book of Hebrews refers to them? All these died in faith without receiving the promises. And here Jacob knows that he's going to die. He's 130 years old. And he also knows that somehow he's going to be brought back to that land that God promised him, but he's going to die here. Can you imagine him thinking through his life and saying, God has promised me that land that we just left, and I haven't owned anything there except a burial plot. I'm just a passing through. Because he knows that his future is only that which God has guaranteed, that he's not going to experience this side of the grave. So as he looks over his life, he looks at 130 years and we say, my, that's a long life. And I think that he's saying, God's talking about forever. And I've had a mere 130 here, and I certainly haven't experienced yet what God has promised. One might look at this and they might think, has Jacob given up? Oh, not on your life. Let's turn a little later in this same chapter. Verse 27. So Israel, Jacob, dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen. And they had possessions there, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. He died at age 147. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, Now if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. Then he said, Swear to me. And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed. He knows that God is going to keep the promise. So where does he want to be identified? With God's promise. He says, don't put me in this ground here, put me in that ground over there, because that's the land that God has promised. Jacob believes the promise. There's no wavering here whatsoever. So, he describes his life as a short and miserable pilgrimage. But I believe that that is in contrast with what he knows God has promised for him. Because he knows that this is just a temporary layover, but that God has a long-term plan, and it will be back in the land of Israel. Well, then in verse 10, Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. Notice that the blessing has been mentioned twice in this passage. It was mentioned in verse 7, and it is mentioned here. It is an extremely important thing that which Jacob did here in blessing Pharaoh. Why would he bless Pharaoh? Genesis chapter 12. Starting at verse 2. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. Be a blessing. That is an imperative. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Jacob recognizes the blessing that has come from God through Pharaoh, through Joseph. It is quite appropriate for him to pronounce a blessing because this is one who is blessing them. And so he is able to say, the Lord bless you. We're not told the content of the blessing that he gave, but it would be along that line. So, in verse 10, he left after blessing Pharaoh. Then in verses 11 through 12, Joseph gave his family land in Ramses, which is the new name for Goshen, and food as Pharaoh commanded. Now, we have to remember, Moses has written this book long after the fact, because he was writing it in the process of preparing the Israelites for leaving the land. And so the readers of this book would not be as familiar with it by the name of Goshen. They would be familiar with it under the name of Ramses. And so in verse 12, then, let's see, excuse me. Verses 11 and 12. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, or Goshen, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread according to the number in their families. Now, we notice that it's called the best of the land, but it's the best of the land for someone who's raising livestock. It isn't necessarily that which the Egyptians would have considered the best of the land. But for their purposes, he's given them the best of the land. But notice then in verse 12, he is providing them with food, which is necessary in part because they've just arrived, but even having arrived, the famine is still in the land. And as a result of that, the land isn't going to provide for their animals as well as it would under normal circumstances, so they're undoubtedly having to draw out of the stocked up grain for their animals as well. In verses 13 through 27, we now get a summary of Joseph's administration. This, in some senses, is a meanwhile back at the ranch, because this already started before the brothers even made their first trip. So we're going to have a summary here, and it's going to mention in particular three of the years. In verses 13 through 14, the first year, Joseph sold grain to those in Egypt and Canaan for money, enriching Pharaoh greatly. Now, there was no bread, or that's a generic word for food, in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. Well, you know, when the supply is low and the demand is high, the prices rise. And it's sort of like this cartoon. No, it's not a cycling holiday, but if the price of gas goes any higher, we'll need a way to get home. Joseph has made wise provision for the nation of Egypt, and as a result, there is food in Egypt. But other places, they just don't have the food. And so as we look at this passage, notice it's not just the Egyptians, but also the Canaanites were coming in order to get food. And the price is that which the market will bear, and the market will bear a high price. So basically, Pharaoh is getting blessed. Just exactly what Jacob prayed would happen. He's getting blessed. He's coming up with a lot of money. That's what happened in the first year. Well, the next year, verses 15 through 17, Joseph sold grain to those of Egypt and Canaan for livestock. Verses 15 through 17. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed." Then Joseph said, "Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for their horses, their flocks, the cattle of their herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. Now, these days we hear a lot of ads on TV about the safety of gold and silver and so on and so forth, but I want you to notice that wasn't paper money there. What was failing them in that day? When the famine gets bad enough, even the gold and the silver start to not go as far as one might hope that they might. He's basically, Pharaoh has cleaned out the economy. He's got the gold and he's got the silver. So the people have their livestock. They were hoping that, well, next year might be better. And so Joseph said, "Well, I'll take your livestock." And they said, "I guess so." So he gave them food in exchange for horses, flocks, cattle of the herds, donkeys, and he fed them bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. Now let's think about the chronology of this, because that's going to be important. How many times did the brothers come to buy grain? Two times. So in the second year, when people were coming, their livestock was being demanded, wasn't it? But what happens to Joseph's family? They still have their livestock. Remember, their money has been returned to them. I don't know that they were even paying the normal market rate that Joseph was charging in these days. So they paid, and then their money came back to them. So they brought that and double the money. And they still have their livestock. Everybody else has been turning in their livestock. And what has happened? They said, we're shepherds. And by the way, we have all of our flocks. So, the result of it is, they had their flocks, but now does it make sense that Pharaoh would say, hey, if any of your brothers are really good at managing animals, maybe we can make them chief herdsmen. All of a sudden makes sense. Pharaoh owns everybody else's livestock except for Joseph's brother's livestock. What is ending up happening is Joseph and his family are being insulated from the famine and from the economic ravages of what is happening now as Pharaoh is getting enriched through the process. Well, then in verses 18 and 19, the next year, Joseph sold grain to those of Egypt and Canaan for their lands and servitude. When that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord is also our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Well, they think that they're going to be planting next year on Pharaoh's lands. They're obviously willing to turn in their lands, but they say, you're going to need some people to plant your crops. We're willing to do that. And we'll become your servants, and we'll give you the lands. This is a pretty desperate economic situation that they are encountering. Well, notice, Joseph's family didn't give up their lands, did they? Pharaoh has given them land. He has allowed them to keep their livestock, and they're in what would be the best of the land, although now during the time of famine, it's not in the greatest of condition. Well, in verses 20 through 22, Joseph bought the lands and put the people into servitude, except for the priests who received an allotment from Pharaoh. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh gave them, therefore they did not sell their lands. Basically, what has happened is Joseph's brothers have risen up into a class of being treated equivalent of how the priests were treated. They are exempt from an onerous set of conditions that have been placed here on the land. It is as though Joseph and his family were in an oasis on the desert. For all intents and purposes, as you look at them, they are being sheltered from the famine, and they are being sheltered from the economic policies that have been implemented here upon the nation at that time. Well, in verses 23 to 26, Joseph, through an executive order, we've heard a few of those recently, exacted one-fifth of the harvest for Pharaoh, which, in light of the severity of the famine, the people willingly accepted. Then Joseph said to the people, "Indeed, I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your households and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. This that Joseph has done ends up fulfilling what had come up in the dreams, but it in no way resembles the administration that God ever wanted implemented upon Israel. But what is the net effect for Joseph's family? Verse 27, Israel prospered in the land of Goshen. Despite everything else that was going on around them, they were sheltered. God was faithful to the promise. God had given Joseph the wisdom to be able to interpret the dreams and then to administer the program in such a way that as his brother's sheaves bowed down before him, they were spared. Verse 27. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there, and grew, and multiplied exceedingly. Now the interesting thing here is, remember how when Jacob first met up with Laban, Laban said, "I'm being blessed because you're here. This is wonderful." And he started out blessing Jacob. But after a while, he started getting jealous, didn't he? And instead of blessing him, he was putting more and more restrictions upon him, changing his wages, making life very difficult for Jacob. And what happened? Ultimately, Laban experienced that the blessing ceased. In Egypt, as it starts out, Pharaoh is very faithful to the promises that he has made. But what do we find when we read in Exodus? Let's turn over a few more pages to Exodus. Exodus 1:8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Now this is 400 some odd years later. But he didn't know the great debt that they had to Joseph, how God, through Joseph, had blessed the nation. And so we know what happened here. They enslaved the Israelites. And God ceased to bless Egypt. God put curses upon Egypt. And God delivered Israel out of the land. I started out by looking at my grandfather, who had sisu, and so no matter how many times he was told he couldn't come into the United States, he eventually did. The Israelites, under normal circumstances, would not have been welcomed. They would have been as unwelcome as my grandfather was when the quota of Finlanders had been reached. And especially the fact that they were sheep herders. They didn't want them to come in. But Pharaoh made a major exception. And he made that exception for Joseph's family because he had seen the blessing that Joseph had brought to them. And what we see out of this is God continues to give object lessons to show that the Abrahamic covenant really means what he said. they were to be a blessing. God would bless those who bless Israel and curse those who curse Israel. You know, I wonder what God thinks of politicians that want to punish Israel for protecting its borders. And why is it that we have correspondents that are able to make such extreme statements and nobody calls it racist to say that all the Jews ought to go back to Auschwitz? What a turn of events we have in our world this day. We have a world that is heading for temporal judgment, and it's heading there very fast. I remember in 1967, as the Six-Day War started, I thought, well, Israel's days were numbered. But then, a few years later, I started finding out about God's promises to Israel. These passages give us much food for thought and much to ponder and pray about as we have politicians around the world that are aligning themselves against the people that God doesn't want to be treated in the ways that they have been treated and are being treated. Let us pray. Father, we thank you for your faithfulness. You demonstrate your faithfulness to Israel, a nation that for its size, by every right, should have been wiped off the map of the earth for all the enemies that they have had through all these centuries and millennia. And yet you are faithful to your promise. You could even make it so that shepherds would be welcomed into Egypt, a land that detested shepherds. Help us to remember that history is under your control and under your direction. We pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And we pray this in Christ's name. Amen.